I'm not afraid to talk about the issues that are going on within our community, the things that are going on as a result of systematic, you know, long-term endemic racism and how it impacts us. I am 100% not scared. They can cut it out the damn show, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to say what I need to yeah. say, because my focus is I ignore the cameras. I mm-hmm. pretend like they're not there. And the person that I'm sitting across from, I don't care, you know, who they are or what they've been through. I am connecting with that person.
In this episode, we welcome Dr. Allison Powell Hicks, a clinical psychologist, TV personality, and consultant who holds a PhD in clinical psychology from Loma Linda University. She's worked in various hospitals and clinics across Southern California, specializing in helping patients with severe presentations and diagnoses. Dr. Ali has also served as a psychologist and coach on shows like Love and Hip Hop and Family or Finance, and was the host of the show Like Mother, Like Daughter alongside her mom on Discovery Plus and OWN. Dr. Ali shares her journey from traditional psychology practice to media psychology and now coaching, discusses the meditative and grounding practices she uses to take care of her own mental health as she treats her clients, and emphasizes the importance of having many mentors with varied experiences. Keep on listening to our conversation.
Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast. Dr. Ali, please tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where you currently live? What do you do? We'd love to get to know you.
Well, fabulous. Thank you so much for having me here, because like, it's so amazing to be able to be at this intersection of mental health and Black women. And so I'm always happy to talk to any audience of Black women, particularly us who are like, let's go into this space that has been so what for so long. So
absolutely.
A little about me. So I have my PhD in clinical psychology with an emphasis in health. And I went to Loma Linda University. So, and I got my master's there as well. I got into a dual program they did both. But anyways, we can talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to get that out the way. So I am a California local. There's not a lot of us. Born and raised in Orange County, California. And then I went to college in Alabama. I actually went to an HBCU there called Oakwood University, which just about nobody's ever heard of.
I think so. Like I've never heard of that. Not gonna lie.
it is a lesser known. It's a very small school, and it is Seventh-day Adventist. So it's a religious HBCU. It's the only Seventh-day Adventist HBCU. So Okay. Very specific and niche. That's what I'm going to say. I met my husband
like
there.
Stories. I was going to say, I was like, I feel like there are stories about that, but we don't have to get into it.
It would have to be an entire episode on deconstructing Christianity for me to have this conversation. But yeah, went there. My parents went there. My grandparents went there. So it is a big family school. Then I came back here for grad school, and I trained in a lot of different hospitals because my emphasis really was health. Well, I started in I wanted to do the neuropsych testing, and it was a little bit of a downer for me because, you know, it's heavy. It's heavy work that you're doing with people that might not necessarily get better the way that you want them to. And I've always been a person who's drawn to more high acuity. And so I tended to work with patients with more severe presentations and more severe diagnoses. And so when you're working with severe patients who have, you know, major TBI, and you're, you know, it gets kind of, you know, it wasn't for me. Yeah. So I pivoted into health and worked at a number of different hospitals around Southern California, Loma Linda Hospital, obviously the inpatient hospital they have there, the BMC. I went into a genetics clinic for a while where I was working with infants doing neurodevelopmental screeners on kids with craniosynostosis. So they had cranial abnormalities. And so we were doing assessments to get an idea of like where we were going to recommend them. Wonderful work. I loved working there. I worked at Kaiser Permanente for a while. I trained at Kaiser in a number of different clinics. One of the clinics I did there was their autism clinic, and that was absolutely amazing. We did a testing and assessment there as well. And Then I went on to Cedars. Well, I was at Cedars first for 2 years, did some research there, did some work in DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, and future directed therapy, which is a lesser known intervention, but is very effective. And then I went on to do my postdoc with children, adolescents in the reward of the court in the system, kids that were in this level 14. It was like a psych hospital. It had an inpatient unit, and then it had like an outpatient unit that was fully locked. And these were very high acuity patients. And I would say about 75% of them had been sex trafficked. Mm-hmm. And that was actually when I, after that, I quit psychology in the classic sense. So yeah. I don't know where you want to pick up, but this is where we are.
Okay. No, I mean, I think that one of the most interesting things as I talk to more and more psychologists, we've had a couple on the podcast so far, is like this tension between doing really important work, but also needing to take care of your own mental health, especially when you're seeing like the worst of the worst, you know? And so are seeing just like situations and encountering stories and people's traumas and just having to like protect yourself from all that. So we're going to just go in that direction. How do you on a regular basis kind of make space for your own wellness and well-being? How did you do that when you were practicing in the traditional sense? And how did that really shape the way that you have transformed your career away from traditional psychology practice into what you're currently doing now?
Absolutely. So back when I was doing traditional psychology, I actually have always been a little bit more esoteric spiritual. So I would use a lot of like meditation while I was working with clients. So I would actively be meditating while I was practicing. Because like, you know, in Buddhism, they talk about walking meditations, and meditating doesn't necessarily have to be some like on top of a mountain. So I would do breath work with myself during sessions. So when things would get difficult, and I would notice, you know, my own counter transference, right? Because we have our own experience while we're in the room. If I noticed my anxiety rising, I don't love silence, for example. So when a client maybe didn't have something they wanted to say, or when they were quiet, I would get super anxious and start over talking. And so I would begin engaging in like my own breaths to allow myself to slow down. So I allow the phenomenological space of treatment to experience, to like exist and kind of rotate and move in its own way. And then after, you know, when, you know, you're kind of left maybe with this residue, this stickiness from some clients, because not every client does that. Where some clients, you know, it's in, out, whatever, but then you have a few, and I've noticed for me, it tends to be clients with personality disorders, mostly cluster B personality disorders, that will kind of leave a little bit more of a residue. It's just because they need your support in different ways. So it's not a bad thing. It's just a thing to be aware of. I would use like a healing light sometimes to kind of like protect myself in session. So I would kind of like start session, and I would like imagine myself surrounded by like either like a rainbow colored light or sometimes a white light, and it would obviously be permeable, so I could still experience my, you know, what was going on with the client. So I wasn't like barred off, like totally barricaded from them, but that I had something to kind of filter between me and them. And I'm telling you, I'm esoteric, so not everybody has to do this. And then after session, so when I would get to work, I would park as far as I could from the clinic, so that after session, I could do an actual walking meditation, and with each step kind of like drop my day and like leave it behind and do my breaths. Kind of like I would do like a 3-step, 1, 2, 3 would be my in breath, 1, 2, 3 my out breath, and make it all the way up to the top floor of the parking garage in the back corner, you know? Yeah. And that was helpful for a really long time. When I was working with the adolescents, it was different because I just loved them so much. They were so great. And it's like, oh my God, how does horrible things happen to you? And that's when I kind of fell out of balance. And so I took a pause. And for me, that was really helpful. And I dove into things that were more creative and for me, very joy-centered, which was media, which was television. And so that's where I found myself for a while. And I wasn't doing a lot of direct client work if it wasn't like in the space of media. And now I feel like I've taken enough of the rest. And so now I'm getting like heavier into coaching and working with clients. And who knows? I may go back to classical psychology. We will see. But right now I'm in the coaching space.
Awesome. All right. So let's get to know a little bit more about your doctoral journey. Would love to know, did you know as a kid that you wanted to be a psychologist? Did you know anything about getting a doctoral degree? At what kind of critical point in your life did you realize and decide, hey, this is something that I want to do? I want to get a PhD in clinical psychology.
Absolutely. So I always wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a neurosurgeon from the time I was like 2 years old.
Okay.
And I am from a medical family. So I am the eighth doctor in my immediate family.
Wow.
Yeah, that's like the family business. That's what we do. My grandfather, my dad's father was an anesthesiologist, and and he lived here in LA. So he was, and he actually was, I think, the second Black man to get his MD from Loma Linda, because they wouldn't let Black students be there by themselves. They had to have a roommate because they couldn't by themselves and they couldn't have a white roommate. So they had to, so I think he was either like the second or like the third Black man to get an MD from that university. So, you know, it's a thing. Then my uncle's an internist. My other uncle was a general surgeon. My father passed away 3 years ago, and he was a family practitioner. And my cousin's a psychiatrist. My other cousin's an internist. And then my mom is a psychologist, PhD, and then me. And I feel like I've left somebody out, but that's us. And so it was kind of understood that you were getting something terminal, like you're getting a terminal degree. So choose ye this day which degree you're going to get. So I went to school as pre-med, and I was a bio major with a psychology minor because I liked the idea of biopsych. And in one of my psych classes, it was at the same time as I was in an anatomy lab. And in our school, we were actually kind of fortunate enough to have an undergrad, a cadaver in our anatomy lab. And a lot of undergrads don't get access to that. And I was taking a class called, The Phenomena of Health and Illness. And it was about the intersection of how medical practice intersects with mental health. Mm-hmm. And we were like in a module talking about how at a certain point some doctors can become distant from their patients because of like burnout of when you're in you know, when you're training and you're not sleeping a lot, and so you can begin to build this more distant relationship with your patients. And I was like, I don't want that. And then during this anatomy lab, our cadaver was trans, and she was a male to female trans woman. And a lot of my classmates were really interested in her anatomy and, you know, what surgical procedures. And I was less interested by that, but I found myself really fixated on her nail polish because her nail polish was like, it was chipped, like mine is, much like it is today. It was chipped. And I was thinking, what was going on in the last few days, weeks, months of this woman's life that led up to her passing? And I was just really trying to connect with her story. And that was my junior year and the beginning of my junior year. And that's when I realized, I think I'm supposed to be a psychologist. I think I'm more into the story than purely the biology, than just wanting, you know, some people just love to, you know, do surgery. Some people just love to, you know, do physicals. I was like, I don't know if that's my bag. So I switched my major to psychology with a minor in chemistry. And I graduated with that. So I ended up having to actually go to another school because my school wouldn't let me take enough credits to catch up so I could graduate on time. So I actually attended Alabama A&M and Open University and took 50 credits in a year so I could get out.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay. You were like, it's going to happen. This is what I'm doing.
4 years ago. 4 years ago.
Love it. Love it. So when you finished your undergraduate degree, did you take time off before you started your doctoral program? How did you prepare for a doctoral program? I know that you've said that you had family ties to Loma Linda. So I'm assuming that it was another family school, but would love to kind of know how you thought about which schools to apply to, which programs would be best for you, and then kind of how much time you spent debating or navigating or even applying to doctoral programs.
100%. So I don't think I put enough energy into application. I was a little on the young side. And so when I graduated, I was 20, or I had just turned 21. And I don't think I was fully prepared for grad school. And so I only applied to two programs. I was very like, I got this in the bag. So I applied to Loma Linda and I applied to Vanderbilt. And I really, really liked the program at Vanderbilt because at the time I was really focused on peds and adolescent work. And they had a really wonderful pediatric program that was connected to the Peabody Institute and or Peabody University, whatever Peabody. And it was a fully funded program. And that's what I wanted. But fully funded programs are super duper competitive. And so I didn't get in and I was literally devastated. Like, this is the end of the world. This is the end of everything. But then I ended up getting into Loma Linda's program, which is not fully funded. So a girl has loans. So that's, you know, that's something to think about. And if I could go back, I wish I would have taken time off because I graduated high school early. I, you know, graduated college when I was, you know, 21 is not young, but I feel like a lot of people are in college at 21, still kind of figuring themselves out. And I was done and in a graduate program by the end of the summer, you know, and most of my colleagues in grad school were in their 30s, you know, or their late 20s was some of the youngest, like 28, 29. And I was, you know, 21. And so I could have went straight in and it was a master's PhD program conjoined together. So you would not be awarded the master's if you didn't finish the PhD. So you had to go all the way through and you came out with both of them, but you had to do a thesis and a dissertation. And there was like an option where you didn't have to do the thesis, but you wouldn't have the degree in the same way. It was something, I don't remember. I might have to ask somebody. But I did a thesis and a dissertation, and I do think that the way that I did it, just kind of like pushing, doing 50 credit hours in my junior year and going straight into an 8-year program. So I was I got my master's and PhD. It took me 8 years to do those. And it was a 7-year program, and I ended up taking an extra year to do an extra year of research at Cedars-Sinai. And it was intense. It was a lot. It was, I mean, grad school is year round. There's no summer, at least my program, there's no summer breaks. Summer break. What is that?
Yep.
You know, and you know, so y'all listening, like, it's not impossible.
Yeah.
It is enjoyable. There's wonderful moments. But it's like, it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
My dad told me that grad school would be like drinking water from a fire hose. He said, basically, mm-hmm. take in what you can, but you cannot expect yourself to take it all in and to get mm-hmm. and to be perfect at all of it. Do not expect that. You will literally explode.
Mm-hmm.
So take in what you can, what you are good at, be the best at, and what you're not really great at, you know, do your best, but, you know, don't fail, but like, don't kill yourself. So those stats classes, I barely made it. And also, grad school grading is a little different where, in my program, a B minus was an incomplete. You had failed the course if you got a B minus. And that's like, not like a curve B minus, a B minus. Like if you got below like an, I think it's like an 85 or 4 in a class, you had to take it over and you got, I think, 3 chances to take any classes over the 8-year period. And then you were asked to leave the program. Wow. So yeah. So it is like, it's real. And I think I officially burned out during our comprehensive exams.
Mm-hmm.
So comprehensive exams are at the end of your time in grad school. You have to take, you know, every school is a little different.
Yeah.
Our school at the time had a written exam and a, like a multi choice written exam. And then a, like a long treatise, you know, where you kind of like, talked about your research, your experience in the program. And it was this really long, you know, book that you basically had to put together. And I remember typing that stinking thing. And I just was in my bed and I just closed the computer and pulled my sheets over my head and was like, I'm done. This is the end. Again, I'm a little bit of a catastrophizer. I was like, I'm never going to graduate, failure, you know, and I finished and I graduated and I did great. And here we are. So I would have taken time off so that I could have also really figured out what I wanted, because I kind of bounced around a lot, with my, or like my focus.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think some of the professors there were kind of like, is she, mature enough to be serious. And I questioned myself, you know, was I mature enough? I made it through. But I think it's partly because I had a lot of doctors in my family who were kind of like guiding me and telling me like, I could do it, I could do it. But I also engaged in a lot of things that made me happy. So I worked as a beauty editor all the way through grad school at a magazine. And I became actually the creative director toward the end. And so, I mean, I was also doing that and I was going to events and doing a lot. So I was double timing it. But my research was in beauty and I was studying body objectification and cosmetic surgery decisions in African-American women. So it aligned actually really well with my work as a beauty editor in African-American magazine.
Yeah, that's our stories are so very, very similar in a strange, like a very specific way, except that I don't come from a family of doctors. But I too started at 21, started my PhD and was, as you mentioned, like the everyone else was just grown. Like everyone else was a full-on adult and, you know, I was a child and didn't know what I was doing. And I too worked, I worked as a blogger throughout my doctoral program and did things, was out in the streets attending little blogging events. And you're right, like, you know, you have to do whatever you have to do to like keep you sane and grounded, even as you're feeling like, well, okay, if I go to this event and that means I'm like not working on my dissertation. And so like, maybe that means I like will take longer, but like, are you happy? So like go to the event if it makes you happy, because it's one thing to finish quickly. It's one thing to finish on time, but like, are you finishing in a way that you are emotionally whole and still sane? And I feel like that's where a lot of us are. We're getting the degrees, but we come out not just burdened with financially with all the debt that we often have to take on, but like we're just broken, so we can't even use our research because we're so broken. We don't want to look at it, we don't want to think about it. So that's something that I've been trying to encourage folks recently, is like, you have to take care of yourself while you're in your program, otherwise it won't matter. It'll just be letters after your name and it won't matter. Other than that, so in your doctoral program, you talked about being the youngest. You talked about not really spending enough time thinking through what would be the right program for you. Ultimately, do you feel like you were able to find good mentors at your program? Were they in your department? Were they outside of your department? You also kind of talked about mentorship from your family members. So just love for you to talk a little bit about where you found mentorship, and if there were any Black women specifically who you identified as mentors along your journey.
Absolutely. I definitely have mentorship in a lot of diverse areas too. Like it's wild, but the head of the department, he is still alive. He's in his late 90s, like 98, 96, something like that. No, he's 92. And I just saw him a few months ago, an African-American man named Dr. Lou Jenkins. And he actually trained my mom in her postdoc at King Drew Medical Center.
I love
and,
it.
Yeah. And he is just, I mean, he has been working in psychology for so long. And I believe he was the first African-American head of this department. And he was the chair when I was there. And he has always been somebody who has guided me through with wisdom. I mean, literally one of the most wise clinicians integrated. And he, one of his like seminal classes that he taught was ethics. And so he was a highly ethical person. And I really honor him and just have loved having him in my life for so long. And then, and I would say he was my primary mentor from the university. I have other teachers that I still communicate with to this day that I would consider mentors as well. And two of them were non-Black men and just amazing. Some of the most amazing guys ever. And I think one of them is the head of the department now. I couldn't go to our last, we had like a alumni day because I'm actually recovering from fibroid surgery that I had in March. And so it was like right after that and I couldn't go. But so then I've always been an active member of the American Psychological Association, and I have some mentors over there as well. And I've gotten some really good support and help. So I'm in a number of divisions, but one of my primary divisions is the media psychology division, considering that, you know, I'm a renegade psychologist on TV. And I mean, not even a psychologist, because I'm a coach, you know, and so I like the term media psychology. But so over there, I have, I would say two really strong supportive mentors that I got. And I'll say I don't think I have a psychology Black female mentor. There's not a lot of us. So I'm going to be honest about that. But I have Frank, and he's an older white man. He's amazing. And Dr. Romney, and she's a woman, and she's amazing. She's gotten me so she's connected me in so many different ways. And she is a media expert in narcissism. She was on Red Table Talk. She did stuff with Vogue. Like, she is just absolutely spectacular. And then I have mentors in media, on the media side of so different producers and execs and people that I have aligned with. And I feel it is really important to either have mentors that pour into you and have tons of time to give to you, and you're kind of like their primary mentor, or if you don't find that, to have like a number of different mentors in a number of different areas. And for me, that made more sense because I'm kind of in this hybrid space where there might not be one person who's doing exactly what I'm doing that has the time to just sit with me and pour into me completely, but to kind of have a number of different mentors in different industries that can guide me and give me advice and support. And like, now I'm writing a book, and so like having like a literary mentor. So there's a lot of different areas that I find myself getting support in.
Yeah, that's such a great, 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 great piece of advice, is to find mentors from a couple of different places, especially if you have interests that are not like very neatly boxed into your specific discipline. I also loved your tip, and I would have never thought of this as a way to find mentorship, but in our professional associations, joining these little smaller niche groups, the subsections, what are they called in the I'm
Divisions.
trying to divisions. There's like another, there's a my I'm in the AH, then I'm a historian. So an AHA, I feel like there's another thing that they call them. But anyway, these little subgroups in your like national professional organizations, that's a way for you to find people, not just as scholars, like whose research you should be looking into, but as potential mentors. I've never thought about that. I've never heard anyone say that. So shout out to you for being the first person to share that on the podcast. That's a really good piece of advice. So we've been hinting at it a little bit. Would love to learn more about media psychology and your, how did you even end up thinking about and interested in psychology for the media, in the media, with the media, on TV? Like, how did that happen? I know that you talked about working as a beauty editor, so I'm assuming that kind of funneled you into this space, but would love for you to just talk about why you decided to either intentionally pursue or accidentally, maybe you, I don't know how you ended up there, but love to know how you ended up as a kind of TV personality, media expert with this amazing research background that you can then use to help people's lives.
Thank you. Well, I love that. So it was kind of my dad's idea because I had a desire to be a doctor, but I really wanted to be a fashion designer and do like interior design and be like a full-born creative and just flutter through the world doing what I wanted. And they were like, you got to get a doctorate, so figure it out. And so as I was going to grad school, I was like, Dad, like, I don't know if I really want to do this. Like, this is really stressful. I'm a free spirit. This is like binding me to the earth. I hate this feeling. And he was like, well, what about just becoming a fashion psychologist? And I was like, he was just like, put them together. He was like, you can just make it up. So I was like, oh my God, like, you're absolutely right. And so that's when I started studying beauty, as a like a concrete construct. So more so like body objectification and the way that we relate to our own bodies, and then that it kind of extended into beauty and how we perceive it, and then that obviously extended into media, because how else do we get a notion of kind of what is beautiful? And there's this whole intersection between evolution and society, this kind of beautiful, complicated balance that we have, where we have on one side the evolutionary kind of beauty needs, and then the society that kind of shapes it more. Anyways, so that kind of got me. And then while I'm working at a magazine, I'm seeing marketing ads, I'm seeing how they're targeting particular groups. And so I was like, so there's something to the way that the human brain works and how we connect to ads, to brands, to products, to particular fashion, particular fashion houses. Why do these girls like OPI nail polish, but these are like strict Essie bitches? Like, what is the difference between the two groups? And
That's a good question that I've never thought about, but that's a good question.
Right? I'm an SE girl. There is a distinct difference because I used to be OPI. It was too thin for me. Anyway, too many layers. I don't have enough patience. So, you know, what are the differences? And so I got into kind of media that back way initially. And so I'm going to a lot of events, I'm going to a lot of parties, and I'm obviously very different from people. I'm not a model, I'm not an actress. I am a professional who writes articles and is sitting in grad school all day. And so I start to see kind of like how there's crossover as I'm interacting with models, entertainers, professionals in that space, you know, producers. And I made a friend, and she was working on a pretty big television show at the time, and she was a writer. And she was telling me some of the things that were going on in the writer's room with a particular character that had experienced a gunshot wound in this show. And it was like, it was a big show. It's on ABC Family now. And she was asking me, like, what do you think would happen to this person? And so I ended up writing up an arc for the season on how the character, along with her family system, how each person in the family system would respond a little differently to the trauma based on the experience that they had had prior. And so then I got really into character development after that and started to help writers develop characters, develop plot arcs that make psychological sense as well, because a character is an individual. And if I sit with individuals all stinking day, I can kind of reverse engineer a creative one, right? Yeah. So that was my first entree, and that was for a show called The Fosters. And that was my first entree into working in entertainment, like officially in television. And then I started doing appearances on a radio show called The Mo Kelly Show on KFI AM 640, because basically I used to go on Twitter and just harass different show hosts who were saying things that I thought didn't make sense and weren't very nice. But I would use like literature and research to kind of reinforce my perspectives. And so the producers were like, that's really interesting. And so I sat down with the producers. They're like, let's go out to eat. And so we went out to eat. And so I started doing Mo Kelly Show, talking about, you know, the, you know, mental health and like narcissism and celebrity and stuff like that. Then I started doing a podcast for 2 years on relationships. And then I got a contract with MTV to do a show with me. And I don't know if I can officially talk about it because the show never happened, but it was me and somebody from the Jersey Shore. And it was really fun, and it didn't become a thing, but it taught me a lot about how to be yourself on stage when you're, you know, when you're in these like scripted, non-scripted spaces. And how do you make sure to balance research and science and, you know, ethics with something that's also going to be interesting to watch. And then I got another show with OWN after that, called I was on Family or Fiance, which I'm still on occasion. And then my mother and I got a show called Like Mother, Like Daughter, where we were helping mothers and daughters to rekindle their relationships. And they were in a house for 21 days. And then I did Profile the Black Man over there. And who knows what other new stuff is coming out. There's actually a show on Hulu that I've done a little appearance on that's airing soon. So
okay, we'll have to keep our eyes peeled. So I mean your work is so interesting, and I think there are probably a lot of people who are maybe not probably are interested on using psychology and intersecting it with media, but even if they are not interested in that specific thing, they are interested in doing something beyond the traditional usages of the, you know, research to academia pipeline. I would love to know, especially as you think about the Black community, you know, when you're working with shows that have predominantly Black casts, like how do you navigate the unique challenges of that arise, like when addressing mental health and relationship issues within the Black community? So like when you are loving hip hop, like, you know, how do you discuss mental health amongst like really high profile in a very public way, Black celebrities? Yeah, just how do you navigate those, like the tensions between, especially with all of the narrative around, you know, the Black family, Black relationships, Black hypersexuality, you know, how do you kind of like juggle doing the work, like actually doing the work that you are trained to do, with the public perception and interpretation of the vilification of these characters online. Not characters, they're real people in the media.
Yeah, but I talk about it. I am not afraid to talk about the issues that are going on within our community, the things that are going on as a result of systematic, you know, long-term endemic racism and how it impacts us. I am 100% not scared. They can cut it out the damn show, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to say what I need to say, because my focus is I ignore the cameras. I pretend like they're not there. And the person that I'm sitting across from, I don't care, you know, who they are or what they've been through. I am connecting with that person and we are having our experience. But for me, what I find is I often don't want to go too deep, right? I'm a coach, and sometimes the shows will want you to talk about certain things. And I talk about what I want to talk about, because I am going to always be ethical. And I'm always going to think about this person, especially this Black person, how are they going to be impacted by this when they go home tonight? How are they going to feel tomorrow when they don't have access to me because I'm not their coach? I'm just was the coach for the show. So these are things that I think about. So one, I'm always myself. And two, I focus on the individual that I'm across from. I'm not necessarily a respecter of persons. So I'm going to connect to you as a human person, no matter what it is that you do, whether you are someone who's done something horrible or you're someone who's done something great. I am a believer in unconditional positive human regard. And I regard people, and I find ways to empathize with people, even if they've done something that other people might not like. Kind of like how, you know, we believe that everyone deserves a defense. I believe everyone, you know, like at some point might deserve some type of mental health treatment, especially if they want it. So, and another part is having to also assert yourself with producers and producer staff, because everyone is different. And most people who are producers on these on teams are not psychologists, right? I don't know every producer that's ever produced, but most of them are producers. They have expertise in film. They understand what they're doing and they are amazing, qualified and talented. And making sure that you stand on your standards and on your ethics is really important. And making sure that if they ask you to do something that you tell them like, nope, I'm not going to do that. Or that's not necessarily ethical. And if they push, you say, nope, I'm not doing it. So you can say whatever you want to say, but I know what I'm going to say. Because I don't remember who gave me this advice. It might've been one of my really close friends. Her name is Monice and she was on Love and Hip Hop. And I think that she said this, but basically was, if you don't say it, it's not, the camera can't record it. Mm-hmm. So you only say what you are okay saying. So if they put it out, they put it out. You know, you force them to have to do too much weird work to make you sound like you said something you didn't say. And that's never happened to me. I always say exactly what it is I intend to say. And it comes off, I mean, 99.99% of the time, exactly how I wanted it to. And so those are some of the things that are important for me, especially when dealing with Black folks, is just giving them the support and the help that they need. Because when you're doing work like this on TV, you're not just working with the person, but you are working metaphorically with the viewer that is dealing with the same issue. And so I'm not concerned about, you know, necessarily like what story does the production team want to tell. I mean, I'll do it, but I'm not as, that's not my focus. My focus is helping this person and by extension, helping all these folks.
Right, right. Yeah, that's such an interesting perspective. You know, this idea that you're not just working with the individual, you're also like working with the prospective viewer. That's like very meta. So like, yeah, high level. So what is your philosophy that drives your career and creativity? How have you know, especially at the very beginning, you talked about you started off in clinical practice, then you moved to psychology, media psychology, and now you're doing some coaching, and maybe you'll go back. You never know. But like, what's the philosophy that kind of drives how you think about your career and the evolution of it?
You know, I am a very in the moment person. I'm very mindful. I try to be as present as I can possibly be. And so I listen to myself. I listen to my guides and I listen to my mentors. And so I pivot fast. That's one thing that I've always been able to do. I don't hold on to things for very long. And so I don't hold on to this idea that like, oh, I have to be this thing. Oh, I have to be like this. I have to be like that. No, I'm going to be exactly how I want to be right now. Whatever that looks like. If people don't like it, move on, watch something else, deal with somebody else. Yeah. I don't care. And as long as I'm comfortable with what it is I'm doing, Right. And so that's a part of my ethos, which is just being very fundamentally aware of yourself. And when I work with most of my clients, I do the same thing. Like the first move I make is awareness. How do we increase your awareness to a degree where we can actually work together? Because if you don't know what's going on, it's going to be hard. Right. And purpose is also very connected to that for me. So I've solidified what it is my purpose is. Mm-hmm. And like my top three motivators are beauty, knowledge, and creativity. So I know if I'm presented with a project that is not in alignment with all three of those things, I'm not really going to be super motivated to continue doing it. Mm-hmm. And so if whatever I'm doing isn't moving in those three spaces, like it's not for me. Yeah. But that allows me to have so many things that are so fundamentally and uniquely mine.
Yeah. Love that clarity. So as we wrap up, we like to ask each guest two questions. So one is, what is one thing that you would do differently, if any, during your doctoral journey if you had to do it all over again?
I would have found a fully funded program and probably waited until I got one so I didn't have a ton of loans. Mm-hmm. Even though I love Lomaland, I would say right now, Lomaland is an excellent program. They made me into a genius. Like, it's an excellent program. But yeah, I probably would have found a grant or something.
Yeah. All right. And then last question, maybe this is related, but what is one piece of advice that you have for prospective or current Black women and non-binary doctoral students?
I would say take your time and love yourself. Like, grad school can be a space where you're used to being the smartest kid in the class. And you're not going to be the smartest kid in the class anymore. Not all of them. Yep. You may have your class. So allow space for you to maybe not feel great every day and not feel like anything's wrong with you because you don't feel great. Life is about ebb and flow. You know, pulling y'all. It's not going to be consistently great or consistently bad. So give yourself the space to like accept kind of like the transitions and changes that are going to happen within the space.
Thank you for that wonderful piece of advice, Dr. Ali, and thanks for joining us on the Cohort Sisters podcast.
Thank you for having me. I love it.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sisters podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sisters membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sisters, please visit our website at www.cohortsisters.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sisters. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sisters podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.